For me, it's one of the best examples of special interest as a regulatory tool, because I can feel the stress dropping off me. You know, it feels like, you know, like melting ice cream, you know, just kind of just running down and running away and going, you know, the weight just disappears.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Special Interest Podcast. I'm Alex.
Hey, and I'm Carly. Thank you for tuning in today. We have a guest that we'd love to introduce you to. So today we'd love to introduce you to Pete Wormby. Welcome, Pete.
Hello. Thanks for having me on. It's been quite a long wait. I think I've had to rearrange a few times, but it's really good to finally be able to be on the podcast. So thank you.
Yeah, we're so happy you're here.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I've listened to the podcast for a while now, and it's just good to be part of that ecosystem of autistic people sharing information and being open and enthusiastic and really getting that information out there. You know, I think it's a really, really great thing. So yeah, just it's part of, I think, a really growing movement, you know, of autistic people sharing their stories, sharing their ideas, sharing their the good stuff, the bad stuff, and everything in between. So yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I'm a biologist, so I love how you just called it an ecosystem, which is very, I feel like, you know, you're an author, so you probably have like a talent for, you know, words and everything. But yeah, would you want to share a little more about your books?
People say that about my way with words. It's always really confusing because I never really understand why, you know. I'll just say stuff, you know, and people are like, oh, that was quite insightful, and I'm like, oh, was it? Okay, fair enough. And I've kind of made a living out of that, you know, by kind of accidentally saying stuff that people like, which is quite nice, you know. I can't complain. It's it's quite a you know, serendipity, you know, just kind of fallen into something here. But but yeah, you know, I've over the last couple of years, I've written a couple of books on the autistic experience. I did something that I wouldn't recommend anyone ever do, which is write two books at the same time. Well, even worse, writing two books at the same time that are kind of on a similar topic. I guess it's okay if you're writing like a fiction novel and a book about, I don't know, dinosaurs or something, you know, that's fine. They're separate. You can keep them in different boxes in your head. But when you're writing two books about autism at roughly the same time, it got very confusing. You know, I would get to the end of a chapter and think, oh, I mentioned that earlier in the chapter, didn't I? And then I'd realize, no, I hadn't. Actually, that was in the other book that I was writing earlier in the day. Now I'm doing something very different. And the scope for confusion was high. So to anyone who's aspiring to be an author out there, that's one big recommendation from me. Well, there's two big recommendations. Get an agent and don't write two books at once. There we go. There's some advice. but they're done now. So I can kind of forget about them in a strange sort of way. You know, they're out in the ecosystem. I'm using the word again. I seem to be addicted to that word. But they're out there being read, being absorbed, being passed around, which is one of the nicest things about being an author that I hadn't expected, actually. It's the fact that you get messages from people saying, oh yeah, you know, I've bought a few copies and given them out to people. I mean, obviously on one hand I like that, because it's like, oh, they bought more than one copy, that's good. You know, I can't lie, you know, that's obviously good news. But it's also the fact that they're gifting it. You know, they're gifting it to family members, to friends, to maybe to their bosses, their colleagues, their children, you know, whoever it might be that they feel needs a better understanding of autism, which is really something. And I never considered that, being someone who doesn't tend to buy books for people often, you know, because I always find buying books for people to be very tricky, you know, for Christmas or birthdays or things like that. But yeah, apparently it's going well. But of course, having said that, none of it's happening in your country, of course. You know, no one in America is able to easily get their hands on my second book anyway, because we haven't got the rights for it over there. We tried to, you know, get them. Obviously, we tried to get a publishing deal, but there doesn't seem to be a huge amount of appetite over there for some reasons that I don't really understand. So I know that some copies have made it over there. I think people must be selling them, you know, like buying them up and selling them over there or something. But in terms of the Kindle and the audiobook, it's very difficult to get hold of, which is a real shame, you know, because, you know, it's America. You know, there's a lot of people there.
Let me know who I need to talk to, because I definitely want to read it.
yeah, it's really tricky, you know, because obviously from our point of view, my agent goes out and contacts American publishers and says, hey, you know, here's a book. It's done quite well in the UK. It's done very well in Australia. I've got loads of translations going on. There's a Chinese translation, Japanese, Korean, Romanian, Polish, you know, all kinds of, you know, translations happening in Europe and Asia. But yeah, we just can't get it going over there. So I'm afraid that you're just stuck with my first book, you know, the one about special interests. But then, you know, that's fine because it's about special interests. So, you know, fair enough.
Yeah, we will be eagerly waiting for that to be published here in the US and we'll be celebrating you when that happens. What kind of led you into the path of writing the books? And also, I don't think you've told us the exact titles of the name, and I want you to be able to introduce the books. If you could do that, that would be awesome.
Yeah, of course. I am the worst salesman in the world. You know, this whole thing about authors needing to kind of promote their stuff, I'm terrible at it. You know, I feel very apologetic and like, oh, I don't really want to make a fuss, but I will do. Yes, I will. So my first book is called What I Want to Talk About. And that is available worldwide, even in America. So that's good. And that is a bit of a life story. You know, it goes over my life from the beginning, I suppose. And it explores all of my special interests, all of my what you could call autistic special interests, obviously, over my lifetime. And I just take the opportunity to use that as a kind of device to frame both my life, but also information about autism around. So, you know, it's a bit cheeky, really. It's like teaching people things without them realizing I'm teaching them. You know, like my first chapter is ostensibly about Lego and my very early childhood. But really, it's about masking and identity and kind of constructing the mask and all that kind of thing. So the idea being that you might enjoy the narrative, you know, of a kid who doesn't know he's autistic, trying to, you know, work his way through the world. But I tried to squeeze in as much information in there as I possibly could. And the chapters just run through my life. So, you know, we go to high school, we go to university, start work as a teacher, and there's various different interests, music, war gaming, video games, the Titanic, you know, it runs all the way through. So that was my first book. And at the same time as that, of course, I was writing my second book, which is called Untypical, which is a more, I suppose you would say it's a broader book. It's about kind of autism generally. Is basically, it's my attempt at splurging onto the page everything I know about autism, everything I've learned since diagnosis, from my own experience and from, you know, so much experience talking to other people, absorbing information, you know, and just kind of getting my head around what it means to be autistic, and trying to get, I mean, the lofty ambition of the book was to try to raise public understanding of autism, maybe just by a few notches. But because public understanding of autism is so low, you know, it's so poor, that actually I don't think it's that difficult to raise it a little bit, because, you know, we're starting from such a low base level, but actually getting it up a couple of notches so people start to understand meltdowns, they start to understand sensory sensitivity, special interests, communication differences. You know, we get that ball rolling. And yeah, you know, it's sold copies, you know, people have talked about it, people have enjoyed it, and it's continuing to do relatively well. So all I want to do really is just be another voice in that crowd, that increasingly sized crowd of autistic people like yourselves, like people who write books, like people who do other podcasts, people who are in the film industry, people who are doing whatever it is they're doing just to raise this level of understanding. And to answer the first part of the question, you know, how did I get there? To be quite honest with you, it's hard to even remember. You know, it was such a bizarre time because it all happened between sort of 2019 and 2022. And of course, that period of time for everybody on Earth pretty much was like a fever dream. You know, we look back on it now, and I was just online earlier, and I read somebody had said something on Reddit along the lines of, you know, everybody's concept of that period of time seems to be really weird. You know, we look back at 2020 in particular, but also, you know, the years after, in a very strange way. So I was writing the books throughout that whole period, and honestly, you know, it all blurs into one. I remember writing the first book on my phone on the sofa late at night, when once my daughter had gone to bed and I had a bit of peace and quiet, and I would just lie and, you know, I wrote the whole book on my phone. I know people who can type on their phone with both thumbs, you know, like amazingly quickly, and it's like, wow, that's impressive. I can't do that. I'm a one finger guy. I tap each letter in turn. It a bum bum bum. So yeah, that whole book was written in predictive, you know, single finger typing. So I don't know how I did that. I genuinely don't. You know, I look back now and think that was bizarre. The second book came a bit easier because I'd already experienced the process, but yeah, it was a difficult time. And these two books somehow emerged from all of that. And yeah, now I'm faced with the challenge of trying to do it again, now that everything's settled down a bit and things are a bit more normal. And I'm kind of worrying, can I do this again in a normal environment? Do I need a crisis, you know, to be able to do this sort of thing? But I'm hopeful that I'll be okay.
Yeah, I really liked how in What I Want to Talk About, you wove, you know, your special interest in with the autistic experience. I definitely thought that was so cool. And I agree with you. Like, I found that, you know, I feel like the reader learns about you while they're learning about, you know, the experience of being autistic in general, you know, for certain people. But for those people who haven't read your book, what has your autistic journey been like?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yes. I mean, it's in some ways it's non-standard, but in other ways, I suppose it's very standard. You know, it's non-standard in that I'm a late diagnosed autistic person. So it wasn't picked up on in my childhood. It wasn't picked up on back in the 90s. I think because I was very much a soak up the discomfort and don't show it to anyone kind of autistic person. You know, I was feeling the sensory discomfort. I was feeling the stress of the communication differences and the social stresses and all that kind of thing. But I just thought it was all on me. I thought it was my fault. You know, I thought I was doing something wrong. So I didn't really want to make a fuss about it. I just tried to blend into the background and be as inobtrusive as I could be and just hide away in plain sight, you know, like wallflower kind of territory. So no one picked up on it. You know, they wouldn't have done that then. It was, you know, the likelihood would be very, very unlikely indeed. So I got to the age of 34, 2017, I was diagnosed, November 2017. So what's that? Like over 5-6 years ago now, quite a long time ago now, actually. So I was diagnosed in 2017, which came at the end of a process of trial and error, trying to work out what on earth was going on for me. I'd kind of just crumbled, you know, in my mid-30s, you know, completely. Just everything just started to fall apart. I was a new dad, and I had a new promotion at work. I was head of department at a secondary school, you know, a high school. So head of English, which is, you know, probably, if I'm honest, the worst job in education. I would say head of English, head of maths, they're the two really nasty jobs, you know, because I would imagine it's similar in the US, because every student has to do those subjects, obviously. They're not the kind of things that you can choose to do, you know, at those older levels, you know, when you're 15, 16, everyone does them. So you've got to be on top of everything. You've got to be super organized. You got to do, you know, check your teachers, you know, your colleagues are doing the right stuff. You got to, you know, be a boss. And it was rough. It was difficult. And I struggled in a way that I didn't expect to. I'd always been very good at work. I'd always been very proud of my ability to cope. You know, I think I was a pretty decent teacher, but it just all collapsed. And in looking into why that might be, I started researching autism. And it just seemed like it fit. You know, it's the story, isn't it? People do a test online and they're like, oh my word, you know, this is me. You know, even when you're reading the questions, you're kind of thinking to yourself, I understand why they're asking these questions. Like, I fundamentally understand why these questions are important, because that is exactly how I feel. I know that I'm different in that way. So when it says something like, oh, I can't even remember the questions now. What were they? What kind of things do they ask? Something along the lines of, you know, when you're at a party, do you feel heart and soul, or do you just want to, you know, crawl away? And it's like, well, yeah, I just want to crawl away into the corner, please. I remember I did one test. I think it was the AQ test, the, you know, autism quotient test online. And I believe it said something along the lines of, when you totaled your score up, a score over 30, I think, was meant that you might want to go and see the doctor, you know, go and have a chat with your doctor and, you know, maybe look for a diagnosis. And I think my score was over 70. And that was quite alarming, because, you know, that's extreme. But I was very lucky. I was very lucky. This was 2017, so it was before the pandemic. Waiting lists at that time for adults were very short, relatively, in the UK. So I went to the doctors, and the doctor was completely in agreement with me, which, again, I'm very lucky for, because not everybody has that experience at all. And I was referred, and I got diagnosed within 6 months, I think, ultimately, which is unheard of now, you know, especially in this country. You know, that's just not going to happen. But then it was just a case of trying to make sense of that new bit of information. I say bit, you know, it's not really a bit of information. It's a massive chunk. You know, it's a huge, you know, thing that I almost use an analogy there that actually I suddenly realized I shouldn't use. I was actually about to say it was like a missing piece slotted into my head. And I thought, oh, my God, don't go down the jigsaw route. You know, don't start talking about jigsaw puzzles, because I hate that symbol. You know, I'm not a fan of that symbol at all for autism. You know, that implication that we're missing something, you know, and we need fixing. But, you know, actually, in a weird kind of way, getting the diagnosis, it did fill a gap. You know, it did. It explained something. I know that's not how they use the jigsaw puzzle piece. That's not what they're trying to say. So, you know, maybe we could reclaim it. You know, we could take it back and, you know, make it our own. But anyway, it felt like it made sense. It made my life make sense at last. And this is something you'll have heard from so many different people. You know, this is the same story. You know, it's always the same thing. We get diagnosed and it's like, oh, my word, now things make sense. And then begins the long, drawn-out process of making sense of your life to date, which, when you're in your mid-30s, is quite a long time to try to, you know, figure out and go back over and relive almost. And it's a very, very long and often quite painful process to do that, you know, to go back over experiences and interactions and relationships and think, now I know what I know. This all makes perfect sense. Even though it makes perfect sense, it doesn't mean it makes it less uncomfortable or more pleasant, because it doesn't. It just provides context that maybe allow you not to blame yourself quite so much or beat yourself up so much, but it still stings, you know? So, yeah, that was a long process. And I think my first book really stemmed from that. I mean, I started talking about it publicly on social media, mostly because I just wanted to make sense of it, and writing about it helped. And I only really like to write if I feel like somebody's going to read it. So I just wrote blogs and tweets and things like that. And they got momentum. People liked it, you know, and my Twitter account joined that ecosystem of other autistic tweeters and bloggers and creators and all that kind of thing that did exist at that time and has continued to exist, obviously. I just, you know, joined the ranks, really, which was an interesting experience. And the books came as a result of that, because when you start to have your tweets get popular, you know, people get in touch and they say, oh, do you want to write a book? And you're like, okay, yeah, why not? And we see that everywhere. You know, we see that everywhere. That, you know, when I think about the number of autistic people I know who have become authors in the time I've known them, you know, that pipeline seems fairly it's going all the time. You know, I can't think of many autistic people I know who have got social media accounts who either aren't published or aren't about to be published. You know, it really, there's so many books coming out and they're so good. And, you know, there's a real incredible amount of stuff coming out now. You know, every month there's new books by brilliant people on various aspects of being autistic. And yeah, I was just one of them, you know, who just managed to get a couple of books out in quick succession, which was nice and tiring and stressful. And then here we are now, you know, where are we? 2024. You know, books have been out over a year now. I'm working on book three. And thinking about book four and, you know, carrying on and on and on, hopefully.
That is so awesome. And it is so cool to see so many different representations now in the form of a book. Like you mentioned, I keep seeing, author after author coming out. And I'm just like, wow, this is so amazing that we're finally getting these stories out there. And yeah, thank you so much for sharing about that in your story. I was wondering how things have changed for you now since having this diagnosis and starting to, I guess now that you're, you know, 6 years out from the diagnosis, what have you learned now? Like what mental space are you at now?
Better, certainly better. I mean, I'm certainly of the opinion that things like depression never really go away. It always feels like they're only ever, they retreat. It retreats for a time, but it's always still kind of there lurking. And, you know, sometimes it just flares up and, you know, it's like hives or something, you know, it just kind of flares up and then it goes back down again. And it, you know, it's very annoying, but it's better now because I can make sense of what's going on more now better than I used to be able to. I can be kinder to myself. I can give myself a break, which is nice. You know, I allow myself to do things that I guess in the past I wouldn't have allowed myself to do. Like, you know, the big one I think that everyone talks about is saying no. You know, just like saying no to stuff. I don't feel so bad these days about cancelling things, as you found out, because, you know, there come points where I simply can't. You know, I do have a tendency to overpromise. You know, I am a people pleaser. I do, you know, the whole fawning, you know, trauma response is a big one for me, as it is for a lot of autistic people. So I am very prone to agreeing to things that actually, you know, on reflection, I probably shouldn't have done. Like I do this training for the National Health Service over here, you know, the NHS, on a weekly basis. I do like 1 or 2 days a week remotely with a co-trainer. And we decide in advance, or, you know, I'll do this section, you do that section, you know, we'll try and keep it all even. We started the one on Monday, and it turned out that apparently in the past like week or whenever we planned it, I'd said, "Oh, I can do. I'll do like more than half. Yeah, I can do that. I'll be fine." And it got to Monday morning, and I was thinking, "Why did I agree to do that? You know, I'm really tired. I've got a really bad headache." And past me agreed to do way more than I needed to agree to do. You know, I said yes to things I did not need to say yes to at all. So I'm obviously still prone to doing it. You know, I think especially when I'm trying to, you know, make friends or seem like a good employee or you know, I don't know what it is. Yeah, people pleasing, isn't it? But generally speaking, I've become much better at knowing my limits, I suppose, you know, and feeling that feeling of loss of spoons, you know, spoon theory, when you start to realize I haven't got much left in the tank. You know, my energy levels have dropped now. And quite realistically, if I try to push myself to do this thing, I'm going to pay for that tomorrow or the next day in some way. You know, I'll be exhausted or I'll have a migraine or, you know, I just won't be able to get anything done. And I'm much better now at managing that kind of thing. And now that I'm self-employed, of course, I'm in a position where I can do that. You know, I'm not having to go into school every day and force myself to get through 5-6 lessons a day, constant contact with people, total masking, 20, you know, not 24 hours a day, but, you know, most of the day having to mask. I'm not having to do that anymore. And I can, you know, I get a bit of work done and then I rest and then I get a bit more done and then I rest. And it's a much better way to be, you know, it's really helped.
That's great. I'm glad you found a schedule that works for you. That's so important. And I'm a teacher, so I totally get where you're coming from. I can't imagine being a department head. That is a lot. Yeah, because I love the kids the best in the job. But kind of going back to what you were saying with, you know, putting up those boundaries with social events and, you know, saying no when it feels right for you. Kind of on the other side of that, what is a good way, like when you do need to put up that social boundary, like what's the best way you feel like someone has accommodated you in the past? Or like, because I feel like we all think ahead, the people pleaser in us, you know, we're like, oh gosh, what are they going to say? So for people who might be receiving that, yeah, what's worked for you?
In terms of having to still say no to them?
Yeah.
It's difficult because you don't want to, you know, you don't want to upset people. And the thing that I found, the thing that, that continues to confound me actually and confuse me is that, I mean, I don't know whether this is the case over there. It might be a very peculiarly British thing, but it's the way that it's so easy to accidentally upset people, you know, accidentally offend people and make them feel bad simply because you don't, you're not able to do something, you know, and it feels to me like a real flaw, to be honest, in the human condition, that we are able to get really upset because somebody literally cannot do something, because obviously it can lead to is bad things. You know, because if you expect or you want someone to do something with you and they literally can't because they're too poorly, they're too tired, they, you know, there's some, you know, really good reason why they can't do it. And that leads to a falling out, you know, like being angry with each other or, you know, being like hostile or if it leads to, you know, a more kind of subtle, passive aggressive kind of reaction. That's awful. That's a nightmare situation. But it's a situation we find ourselves in all of the time. You know, and it's just absolutely bewildering to me. It really is, because it's like everything we do is picked apart for ulterior meaning. Like there's something else going on, you know, when there isn't necessarily. And I think this is one of the big interesting, I'm going off on a bit of a tangent here, but it's one of the really interesting communication differences between non-autistic and autistic people from my experience. Is that I don't think that autistic people necessarily, although we can, but we don't necessarily always assume that there is something else happening there when we're in conversation, when we're, you know, saying we can't do something or saying, you know, oh, I don't want to do that or whatever. I think it's more likely just to be taken as, oh, you don't want to do that. Okay, that's fine. Fair enough. You know, I understand people don't want to do things. Whereas with non-autistic people, it can be taken as a real personal attack. Like, I don't want to spend time with you. I don't like you. I never liked you. I'm not going to like you in the future. And it's like, I'm not saying any of that stuff. I'm literally just too tired. Like, if I come out, you're going to have to provide a bed and pillows. I'm sorry. No, I just can't. So it's a real mind thing. You know, you can't really win. It's inordinately tricky to navigate that space of trying not to make people unhappy when you need to look after yourself. I personally believe that honesty and clarity is the best policy with all of this. You know, if you sense that the person is getting upset because, you know, you can't make their birthday party or you can't manage to do whatever. I can't even think of any random social events. But, you know, you can't do it. Then just being completely, you know, cards on the table, you know, so it can't be filled. So that the mystery of why you're not going can't be filled with conjecture because you've clarified it, you know. So rather than just saying, look, I can't come, I'm too tired, because that can feel like a bit of a, you know, an excuse, you know, explaining why you're too tired, perhaps, you know, like not in enormous detail. That would be a very autistic thing to do, wouldn't it? You know, going to enormous detail about exactly how tired you are, but just to give some, you know, some reasons, just to nip in the bud that idea that you might be, you know, that you don't really like them and this is all just excuse making and I don't know. But yeah, even thinking about it now fills me with like a nervous energy, because it's such a common source of discomfort. And like I say, especially over here, because in the UK, there is a tendency, I think, that everything is very much unspoken. You know, our communication style is, and our social interaction style is very, it's all to do with implication and inference. Nothing is ever stated clearly. It's all very murky and foggy, which makes being autistic even more difficult. You know, we can't just, you know, we can't just ask stuff. We can't just say stuff here. It all has to be carefully constructed to come across as properly polite. You know, you can't just ask for a drink. You have to hint that you want one by suggesting it's too warm in here, or, you know, oh, I haven't had a cup of tea since this morning. You know, that's how you then get offered a drink. Whereas I think in other countries that aren't quite so peculiar, they would just say, hey, can I have a drink, please? And everything would be fine. So, yeah, I'm not sure whether I answered your question there. I kind of went off on my own thing a little bit, I think. I do have a tendency to do that.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it was an all-encompassing answer, which was good. So.
Next, I wanted to ask you about your special interests. What are your special interests? I know you mentioned Legos. Is there any other special interests that you want to talk about?
what a tremendously dangerous question that is to ask.
I know. Did you feel the hesitancy of like, how do I word this to just like open the can of worms?
Yes. Well, it's really interesting to me because whenever I'm asked that question, because I am asked it in good faith these days, you know, people like yourself and other people, you know, because they know I'm autistic and they know I've written about this stuff, they ask it and they mean it. You know, they want to know, but I still feel a blockage in feeling comfortable to talk about it because of, you know, a lifetime of it being denied. You know, I think most autistic people know that feeling of you try to talk about a special interest and people aren't interested. They tell you to be quiet, or they tell you, oh, stop going on about that thing again, for goodness sake. Do something different with your time, you know, that kind of thing. So it's weird, you know, I still get it, like a hesitancy. Do I really want to, you know, open myself up, you know, because there's a vulnerability to it. You know, here's my favorite things, the things that mean more to me than anything else. There's a vulnerability there that people can stomp on, you know, and parents and teachers and people in authority did that when we were kids, you know, whenever we wanted to talk about Sonic the Hedgehog or whatever it might have been. But yeah, I mean, I've got a lot. There's obviously, I think, 8 or 9 described in the book, you know, Lego, dinosaurs, video games, Minecraft specifically, comic books, superheroes, all that kind of stuff. But the and you know, if you want to know more about that, then obviously you can have a read of the book, you know, it's all in there. But there were a few things that didn't make it into the book for various different reasons, really. Some because I didn't have them at that point, because of course special interests, they come and they go, you know, sometimes they're not always, you know, for life. They can fade out and fade back in again. But also some just didn't make the cut, you know, or I didn't feel like I could give it enough space. I mean, one of my most enduring special interests is maps. I love a map. I really do. I can immerse myself in maps for hours and hours and hours without ever getting bored. And I'm not even really doing anything with them. Ever so strange. You know, it's not like I open a map like Google Earth or, you know, an old kind of Victorian maps that's really detailed with anything specific in mind. You know, I don't open it to think, right, let's have a look at something. You know, I just open and I browse it in the same way as you might browse the internet or a bookshop. I just kind of just gaze at it and just see if anything takes my interest. And it's, for me, it's one of the best examples of special interest as a regulatory tool. Because I can feel the stress dropping off me, you know, it feels like, you know, like melting ice cream, you know, just kind of just running down and running away and going, you know, the weight just disappears and I feel much better as a result. I always used to have Google Maps open at school when I was a teacher. So whenever I got the kids doing some task, you know, getting them busy for a time, 10 minutes or so, I could go and sit at my desk and just quick, you know, have a quick look at a map, you know, just of anything, and it would really help. And in the UK we have this website that is incredible. It's the Scottish National Library. What they've basically done is they've taken every historical map they could get their hands on of the UK, you know, the whole country, and scanned it all in so you can browse it online, but with the ability to compare it to the modern Google Maps satellite view. And it's like for like. So, for example, if you're in, you know, you can go and look at London, you can look at Oxford Street in London. And on one half of the page, you're looking at the, you know, the current Google Maps, you know, satellite view of Oxford Street, you know, horrible and busy and smelly and polluted. And then in the other one, you've got the Victorian, you know, from like 1860 or something, you know, really detailed map, you know, really impressive scale. And you can compare and you can see how things have changed. And you, oh, that street's disappeared now. Oh, there used to be a pub on that corner. It's gone now. Or, wow, there was like a little warren of alleyways and things, and now it's just a skyscraper. For me, for some reason, that it's like a drug. You know, it is incredibly, I don't even know a word for it, you know, fascinating, compelling, just to compare how things have changed. I remember spending a very happy afternoon. It was like the whole afternoon comparing the coastline of Eastern England, because the sea had washed away. You know, the erosion's quite severe on the east coast of the UK. I think it is on the east coast of America as well. You know, kind of, you know, the sea's kind of encroaching all the time, and there are lost villages and all sorts of stuff that have been washed into the ocean. And you could see it on these maps. You know, you could see these little villages and pubs and manor houses and fields that have all vanished. And yeah, for me, that was like one of the, that was like genuinely one of the happiest afternoons of my recent life. just comparing these maps on a screen. It's extremely interesting how that monotropic flow works, you know, how just the enjoyment of it, of being in that state. And then of course what happens if someone comes along and tries to drag you out of it by asking you to put the bins out, or you need to go to the shop or something like that, and you know, it all shatters and you're back in the real world and you're being asked to do something and everything kind of goes wrong and you feel your stress levels rocket. And yeah, it's endlessly interesting to me. So yeah, maps are a big one.
That's awesome. I also love you, like, just going on Google Maps and looking at, you know, what's going on in different areas of the world. So fun. But you brought... Oh, sorry.
Well, I was about to say, you know, I mean, I've never been to the States ever. I mean, maybe one day. But one of my favorite things to do is to go over to somewhere like the States or Canada or Japan or somewhere like that. And just plonk myself down on Street View and just move through the streets, maybe somewhere really unusual, like not New York City, but somewhere a bit odd, like, I don't know, like a small town in Iowa or something, you know, somewhere that I'd probably never go. And just, yeah, just kind of walk through, you know, kind of, you know, virtually and just look around and see the differences and see the similarities. I don't know, it never, ever ceases to fascinate me.
Yeah, it's like a kind of new age traveling.
Yeah.
But you mentioned that special interests are regulating for you. And I was wondering, you know, what other, like, how else are special interests meaningful to you? Like, how do they add value and, you know, that richness to your life?
Yeah, well, in quite a few ways, really. I feel like, yeah, there is the regulatory aspect, which is obviously a very kind of technically useful thing. But there is also just pure enjoyment, you know, just sheer fun, which, you know, let's face it, is underrated. And we don't get enough of it, especially in adulthood. And I think special interests give you a really unfettered access to that. And I think when you are super duper stressed out, as autistic people tend to be, you know, masking all day at work, masking all day at school, stressed out by sensory overwhelm and all those conversations went wrong because people aren't translating themselves to you at all and you're having to do all the work yourself, having that space to just do something that is purely enjoying, you know, just pure enjoyment for you is worth its weight in gold. And it's interesting to me how frequently, especially for autistic kids, you know, a punishment will be the removal of a special interest. And it's like, wow, you really like realizing what you're doing there, you know, by doing that to an autistic child. You know, you're really removing some really powerfully positive things from their life in an attempt to get them to be, I don't know, like a better human being in some way. You know, it just seems to be a fundamental misunderstanding of what might have caused the behavior challenge in the first place. But beyond that, there's also various other things. I remember talking in the book that I found that special interests at certain points have been a really good way of breaking me out of my comfort zone. I think this is probably true of a fair few autistic people. It can be very tempting to stay in your comfort zone because it's comfortable, obviously. And because things are so stressful and we're carrying around that stress all the time, that it almost becomes nonsensical to even consider leaving your comfort zone. Like, why would you? Because you're just going to be bombarded. You know, it's almost like leaving a little colony on Mars or on the moon or something. You know, you're safe in there. You don't want to leave because you'll be bombarded by solar radiation and, you know, the cold and the vacuum of space. No, you want to stay put in your little safe space. I think that's how it can feel. You don't want to go out into the outside world and socialize because you're not necessarily introverted, but just past experience has taught you, you know, you're not going to have very much fun out there. So actually having some special interests that might encourage getting out and doing stuff and meeting people can be really positive, I think, for autistic people who might not be introverts. You know, we're not all introverted. We're not all people hating solitary loners that want to spend all their time in an attic or a basement. You know, I mean, like I've always made the joke that I very much am that person, but I don't think that's the standard for autistic people. I think there's a huge variety of social needs, and autistic people can get lonely. Of course we can. And I think special interests can help combat that, because it might be that our special interest is something that takes place outdoors. You know, I can think of somebody, for example, you know, they love horse riding. You can't horse ride in your living room. You know, you've got to go outside. You've got to go to the stables, and there's going to be other people there. And you'll get to just have that little bit of interaction, which is probably all you need as an autistic person, you know, to feel a bit happier and a bit more comfortable. But you've had it, you know, you've got that. I think that my special, it's not really a special interest, it's more a routine thing for me. But for me, going for a coffee every morning, yeah, it's definitely a routine, even though a special interest of mine is quality coffee. Going for a coffee every morning just gives me that opportunity just to say just a couple of words to the person behind the counter. I'm not going to sit and have a chat with them. I don't do small talk, but I can just, you know, hello, oh, same again. Yes, please. Thank you. You know, that just a little interaction that keeps my mood a bit lifted, you know. But if your special interest is something like when I was in a band, you know, for a time, my all-consuming special interest was writing and performing music. And, you know, that forced me to do things that I would never, ever have done otherwise at that stage of my life. You know, nowadays, getting on stage for me is second nature. You know, I was a teacher for a long time, and now I do talks and speeches and all that kind of stuff. But when I was in my early 20s, no. That was not something I wanted to do. I was, you know, I was very, you know, withdrawn at school. You know, I didn't want to be the center of attention. But all of a sudden, the interest almost forced me to do things that I wouldn't normally do. And in doing that, I found some enjoyment and some new facets to life, you know, and things to really find interest in. And, you know, if you think about something that is very sociable, like, you know, playing board games, for example, just, you know, as a random example, playing board games, playing Dungeons and Dragons or something like that, you know, it gets you out of the house. It gets you down the local cafe or pub or bar or wherever, you know, a friend's house or somewhere. And it gives you that chance for a bit of socializing in a safe space with like-minded people, where the likelihood of that socializing going wrong, you know, and you know how it can be, you know, and being bullied and being treated badly for being different is much lower. You know, it's a safe social environment. And that is, like, you know, it's incredibly powerful, incredibly useful, incredibly beneficial, I think, for any autistic person who finds that otherwise they might be quite lonely, you know, might be quite withdrawn from the world, because the world is a scary, scary place. So yeah, I mean, there probably are other things, but I mean, you know, self-regulatory, just pure enjoyment, extra socializing and pushing you out of your comfort zone. You know, these are four really powerfully good effects of special interests, in my opinion.
I love that. Thank you so much for sharing about, yeah, the value that your special interests give And I was wondering, what advice would you offer to someone that has just discovered maybe later in life that they are autistic?
Yeah, good question. I think the best thing that you can do, you've got to find your people, I think. Because the thing that people often forget, especially non-autistic people, is that when you are given your diagnosis, you're not really necessarily given any further support. I mean, I was sent on my way with a couple of bits of paper, a few pamphlets, you know, photocopied pamphlets and nothing more. I wasn't offered therapy or given any advice or really even pointed in the direction of anything really, truly useful. It was very much, oh, you're autistic. Bye. Good luck. and that was that. And being diagnosed, it doesn't really answer any questions. It provides you with the key to the answers, but it doesn't provide you with the answers. You know, you need to then go and find out what being autistic really means. You need to go and find out about sensory stuff and executive function and communication differences and alexithymia, interoception difference, you know, all of these things that you've probably never come across in your life up to that point, because who would? You've got to go and find that stuff. So if you are newly diagnosed, the first thing I would recommend is getting online if you're able to, and just following a few autistic accounts on social media. I'm not going to say you have to follow mine by any stretch. Everyone will find the people they want to follow, you know, the people that work for them. The reason being that you don't necessarily have to do active research. What can really help is just if you just follow a few. So then when you're doing your scrolling, you know, like for me, I'm looking at my Lego castles and I'm looking at my train sets and I'm looking at my tornadoes or whatever it is I'm scrolling on Instagram. Every now and again, something will come up of some autistic person's insight into something. And it might be something I've not thought about before. And I'll be like, oh, that's interesting. You know, and you gradually start to absorb this stuff. You gradually start to get a picture and an idea. And then you'll very quickly, once you've got a few, you know, once you've got a few autistic people in your orbit that you follow and you read their stuff, you watch their videos, then you might start to get a sense of which books to look at, you know, because as we talked about earlier, there are so many books now written by autistic people of all different demographics. So no matter what demographic you might be, there's going to be a book out there that's going to be, well, to some extent at least, addressed more to yourself. You know, for a long time, for example, there were no books for autistic women at all, you know, for a very long time. And now there are lots of books for autistic women of color, autistic women who might be, you know, autistic non-binary people, autistic gay people, autistic trans people. There are books out there that are helpful and that contain information and advice for so many more different groups of people now than they used to be. So if you've got your ear to the ground and you're, you know, you work your way into that ecosystem of social media, Instagram, Twitter, well, not Twitter, Facebook, etc., you can find the books that are going to help you personally and you can read them. And that can be a jumping off point then for reading some more stuff. And you will gradually start to build up a better understanding of what it really means. It's not a quick process, but I think it saved my life, if I'm honest with you, going through that myself, you know, but just by on the off chance of going on Twitter and discovering, to my surprise, I think, because at the time I didn't know it was a thing, but discovering that there was autistic Twitter, you know, that it was a whole thing. There were loads and loads of accounts talking about their autistic experience. And here I was, newly diagnosed, thinking, oh my God, this is amazing. Like, wow, how lucky that this exists. Because I could read these things. And, you know, some of the people that I met in those early days, I'm still in contact with now. You know, we're good friends in some cases. You know, and it explained things to me in a way that really, really helped. And like I say, if it hadn't been for that, I don't know where it would have gone. You know, being given that news about being autistic, it didn't solve anything, really. It can't until you get the understanding. Then, yes, then you can start to work on things and start to figure out what works for you. But without that, it's very difficult. It's just another bit of information that's meaningless. You know, it's just a label that who knows what that even means for me. So get yourself online if you can. Get yourself some books. Watch some YouTube videos. There are so many quality creators out there making stuff.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. And coming to the end, we were wondering if you have, like, any last I was going to say last words.
I was going to say, wow, this is taking a little turn. Grim.
But like anything you want to relay to our community that you haven't already.
Oh, what a question. I mean, yeah, probably lots of things. I think what I would suggest to anyone listening is I'll say something about books. Actually, I think if I may, because there might be a lot of people, you know, listening to this one in particular, you know, because I am a writer, who might be thinking, oh, you know, how do I get into that world? So all I would say is, if you're autistic and you want to, you know, write and you want to talk about your experiences, then do so. You know, there's not a better time to do it than at the moment. You know, people want to hear this stuff. So put pen to paper. No one does that anymore. Put fingers to keyboards or single finger to the screen of your phone, if you're me, and get it written, you know, and if it just becomes a blog, then fair enough, get that story out there. Because as I said a couple of minutes ago, the power of community in the autistic world is incredible. And adding your voice is never going to be a bad thing. You know, getting that voice added out there is never going to be a bad thing at all. It just adds further variety to that rich tapestry of autistic experience that is increasingly existing in printed form, you know, in media, permanent form. Don't hold back. Get it out there and provide that insight to a world that really desperately needs it.
Thank you so much, Peter. Thank you so much for being here and for giving us your time and space and energy. It's been really lovely to get to know you and hear more about yourself and your story. Everybody that's listening, go check out Pete's books, What I Want to Talk About and Untypical. We are just so honored to share this space with you. And thank you again for coming on, Pete. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We will catch you again next week. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.